VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from the Times. It's another bank holiday Monday here in England. And of course, I made the joke before, I'll say it again. The banks decide when you get to have holidays. Isn't that great? Anyway, I'm Gabriel Marcotti. I thank you all for joining us. And I'm especially excited today because there are three people with me and they're all here in the studio and they all work for the Times. So please welcome the excellent Alison Rudd, the excellent Matt Hughes, and yes, this joke is about to get very old, the only living Gearbrandt in captivity. Not many goals on Saturday, this weekend, but it was massive. It was, you might call it a heavyweight weekend in the Premier League on Sunday. So let's start with a final North London derby at White Hart Lane. Alison, Arsene Wenger puts out his back three again. But Spurs kind of ran right through it, right?
Spurs go, no. We're going to play back four, so there. I've been surprised. I mean, we've praised Wenger for having the imagination to switch to a back three late in the season.
Without actually training for it, preparing for it,
having
the people to do it, dropping Bellerin.
Yeah, I was surprised he did it because prior to switching to a back three, when he's been asked about why haven't you thought about a back three, because of the success that Chelsea and other teams have had with it. Wenger's argument was he felt the success Chelsea had with the back three was because it played into the hands of the talents of Matic and Kante and gave them the ability to control the game and the midfield and so on. And it wouldn't work unless you had players of that calibre. Arsenal patently do not have players of that calibre or even remotely similar. So it seems slightly strange you would copy the template when you've already said the template only works if you've got a certain type of player and he hasn't got that type of player. So you go to a team that are rocking and you basically say, please run all over us. It is slightly strange. But I can't diss it completely because up until this point it had worked for him because they're in a bit of a crisis. And if they were believing that three at the back was giving them something, that's all that matters, isn't it?
I mean, it kind of worked initially because Oxlade-Chamberlain was very good as a right wing back, but I mean the sample size is too small to kind of judge really because they beat Middlesbrough, who were awful, then they beat City in the cup, and then they really fluked to win against Leicester. So I don't know, has it worked? I'm not sure.
I wish people could see his face. He looks absolutely disgusted.
It's the face of it's the face of a man who's sick of watching and talking about Arsenal.
I know,
and I don't even support them or care about them. Imagine how the fans feel. Well, you know how the fans feel.
I renew my pledge not to talk about Wenger's future or Stan Kroenke. I'm curious about something, James. It seemed to me like Spurs didn't really care. They didn't feel the need to match this. And, you know, even though in the first half they didn't score, I don't know, that maybe I saw the game incorrectly, but I thought they always felt like they were going to win.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one thing that I think is quite interesting about Spurs is their tactical flexibility. I mean, watching them against Palace, they changed formation a lot during the match. It's one thing to change formation from match to match, but to be so comfortable to play...
Does that make him a tinker man, which is bad?
No, I think it shows how well-drilled Spurs are, how well-drilled they are on the training ground, to have the comfort to do it actually within matches, I thought was impressive.
Listen, I'm interested in one thing. Kyle Walker's fit, right?
He is fit.
As far as we know, because he seems to come on and run really fast when he does. Are you surprised or interested in the fact that
you know, he starts Trippier. He doesn't seem to be automatic when a lot of people would have had him as one of the top English right backs around.
Yeah. Well, the rumor is that they're falling out. Ooh, it's hard to believe.
That's more spread rumors.
Well, it's hard to believe that Pochettino falls out with anyone. Really, he's so paternalistic. They all seem to adore him, but he doesn't have favourites. He puts winning first, and he's clearly put. He feels if Trippier's in slightly better form, or if it's the system better, or he's just fresher, he's going to play him. After the cup final, Kyle Walker was supposed to be annoyed. They hadn't done anything wrong and yet hadn't been first choice. And they were supposed to have had words. And now all it takes is something like that, a little crack in the fortress at White Hart Lane, and people think, oh, that's someone we can buy. And therefore, Kyle Walker must be interested in leaving if he's going to be snubbed. I mean, if you just step back from it, it's slightly pathetic to think that that is enough to make you want to leave Spurs. Just a couple of being benched moments. I would have thought Pochettino is perfectly capable of convincing him that he's still very important to the team.
To most Premier League teams, and you probably double your money if you leave Tottenham for a fellow top four club. It's interesting. There's definitely something going on there. The theory is that Walker is maybe the one player that Tottenham will sell because they've got Trippier, who is a very credible alternative.
But he's so different. I mean, Trippier's not quick like Walker. He's maybe slightly more technical, and I don't know.
Acceleration, but he can still get forward and attack. He's not a sort of.
But he does it based perhaps more on technique than athleticism than, you know, relative to Walker. Then defensively, maybe he relies a little more on. I don't think either is to say outstanding defensively, but.
I think Trippier's probably slightly better defensively, I would say.
Trippier's more measured, I would say. Sometimes Walker looks a bit. He's dashed there almost too quickly and doesn't quite know what to do, whereas Trippier thinks and does.
Is it not also partly that kind of balancing act that you have to do when you're a manager in order to have really high quality cover at certain positions? Because I think we're all agreed that, you know, Kieran Trippier, by the standards of reserve right backs, is a very, very good right back. Yeah. And you're never going to retain a reserve right back of that sort of quality if you don't actually give him a lot of games per season. It's a little bit like the rationale that Arsene Wenger uses with David Ospina when he plays him. It's different, but it's the same kind of.
I think
it's not new. I mean, last year, the four fullbacks were rotated quite a lot as well. I guess the difference is that Kurt Walker's missed the cup semi-final.
Well, what I find interesting, and I don't think there is a correct answer to it, is do you want your backup or your alternative to have the same skill set and be a similar player to your starter, or do you want him to be different so that when he comes on, things change? So there's obviously pros and cons to both. I mean, to me, they are just very different.
I thought you'd want a different option, personally, but...
Right, some people might say that, but you can also make the point that having a different option means that the way somebody goes down to injury and your team's working great, then everybody else has to adjust because the guy who comes on is going to be different.
I suppose it comes down a little bit against that question of kind of flexibility versus rigidity. I mean, if you're, say, Chelsea, and you have, for now at least, a very, very set way of playing, you're going to want your backups to be very, very similar and to be able to slot into that quite rigid system.
You'd want
system.
To have a bad version of Diego Costa backing up Diego Costa. Correct. Not somebody who's entirely different. Talking about somebody who I think is way different and who I think is outstanding, that's Dele Alli. I know we sometimes get carried away, but I look at this, he's so young. Can you guys are no doubt, well, I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody. When's the last time somebody his age was that good in the Premier League?
Wayne Rooney.
You have to go all the way back to Wayne Rooney?
English, certainly. Fabregas, I suppose.
Fabregas was the other one, I thought.
Would have come slightly superseded Rooney and was even younger, wasn't he? He was 16, 17 when he was first playing for Arsenal. So, yeah, it's over a decade.
Any Dele Alli theories about why he's so good, why he was at MK Dons for so long and didn't get plucked away earlier by greedy academies?
No, because he was playing. And he, you know.
I know, but he wasn't playing when he was 16 years old.
He wasn't playing. That's the point.
Was he?
Yeah,
he was playing.
Yeah.
He was in
his debut at 16. He's only 20 now, and he's been at Tottenham for two years. And he's played, whatever, 200 games for MK Dons. Yeah, he was playing every week in League One at age 17. So, you know, they got £5 million, which now looks like a bargain, but they've got a big sell on as well. Liverpool and Newcastle both had chances, and it was quite funny. Ian Ayre was giving interviews in Liverpool last week. He's about to leave Liverpool to go to 1860 Munich, I think, anyway. He was asked about Ali and said at the time he didn't think he was worth the money, which doesn't look like a very good judgment there.
I have to say, from what I've been told, he wasn't the only one who felt that. I think there was some division, even at Tottenham, about whether he was worth it. I'm looking around the room. You guys don't all seem excited. I mean, if I were English, I'd be bouncing or not you, because you're negative.
We've been excited for 2 years. It's not news that Dele Alli is a good player just because he scores in the North London Derby.
But you know, I was at Wembley last week when he made. He needs to improve his decision making off the ball. Some of his tackles are poor. You know, we don't want another poor Scholes on our hands. So while I think he's brilliant and a great player, he could get even better, you know. If he doesn't give away those free kicks last week, then maybe Spurs will be in the cup final. No.
I think the amazing thing about Dele Alli is his productivity at such a young age is so outstanding. I mean, the number of goals that he scored is quite remarkable, really. I think with young players, it's very easy often to get excited about sort of intangibles. But with Ali, he really has that output. For Ali to actually be producing already, I think, is what kind of puts him in another level of prospect.
Put a different way, if his output fell 30%, you would still consider him one of the absolute greatest prospects in this game.
And he's so flexible. No wonder Pochettino loves him, because he can play almost anywhere.
Imagine Nigel Pearson is more flexible than he is.
Yes.
Sorry, that was gratuitous. Sorry, Nigel. Interesting there. I think nobody reacted to a quote from Matt Hughes a few minutes ago when he said, "We don't want another Paul Scholes on our hands." And I know what you mean, but it is the kind of thing that can come back to haunt you on social media. So I probably shouldn't be highlighting it by talking about it.
Yeah, thanks.
Even with the victory, though, the gap remains 4 points because Chelsea went to Goodison Park and won 3-0. Now, I thought Everton were going to put up a much, much bigger challenge at home. And it took Chelsea a while to actually score, but they did create a number of chances before that, Hughesy. Did Everton get this wrong, or is it just a case that Chelsea just raised their game?
I thought Chelsea played really well yesterday. Obviously, the goals were emphatic in the end, but they had a lot of chances before then, and for an away performance, it was very impressive. A lot of it was counter-attacking, but they were relentless with the way they poured forward. And I just thought, again, it showed what a really good team they are, and they've had an amazing week, haven't they? They've, you know, beat Spurs at Wembley and then two Premier League games when they're under pressure against good teams. They've delivered, and we're seeing why they'll be worthy champions, I think.
Our colleague Duncan Castles pointed out after United beat Chelsea in the league that, and Herrera sort of did that man marking job on Eden Hazard, that, you know, other teams are going to find Conte out and replicate that. Ronald Koeman certainly tried, James, didn't he, by putting Idrissa Gueye on Hazard for much of the game. In his case, it didn't quite work.
We spoke when Herrera did it about Herrera being quite an interesting choice because he has so much attacking responsibility. To tie up a player like that, you risk losing that. Although, as it happened, Herrera played exceptionally well and it worked. But I think Gueye would have been a more natural choice. It didn't quite work. I think Gueye's actually had an excellent season. But I think it just shows the class of Hazard that he was able to overcome that. He was able to then kind of adapt his game slightly and play a very influential role in that match.
I thought
Hazard was very, very quiet, and I thought in terms of pure man marking it probably worked, but the problem was that the rest of the Everton team didn't work hard to back that up.
Well, that's the problem, right? If you man mark somebody, then the guy just drags the defender out of the position. You have to make sure somebody goes and slots into that area that Gueye would normally cover in front of the back four, and it felt like that's actually where Everton were particularly weak.
Yeah, and Gueye, it proves that Gueye's been very important to Everton having this amazing run at home. That he covers, you know, he's like a version of N'Golo Kanté. And to take him out the game with giving him just one role, I don't know. It just made Everton look a little bit they were a little bit dull and fragile.
Dull and fragile is not what we expect from Everton. I get people complaining to me on social media that, you know, why are you always talking about Lukaku and Barkley leaving? We have a billionaire owner now. It's not going to happen. You know, we're going to go and spend and be big and retain these guys. Matt, do you want to take this one?
I think Barkley will stay. I mean, the issue is whether Koeman actually really wants him to, because he seems at best lukewarm. Tottenham like him, but they're not going to pay him more than 100 grand a week, because that's what Harry Kane and Hugo Lloris get paid, so he's not going to go in right at the top of their pay scale. He could earn a lot of money at Man City, but he'd probably be, you know, the next Jack Rodwell if he went there and didn't play. So I think he'll probably stay and eventually sign, and this sort of back and forth is just about money, really. Lukaku, he looks like he wants to leave, and he probably will. The interesting thing is whether any of the real big clubs that want him, Chelsea, if they're willing to put the money down, and how determined Everton are to keep him. I mean, they succeeded in keeping Stones for an extra year. Maybe Lukaku's had, this is his extra year, because obviously Chelsea were here for him last time and didn't pay the money. So I'd probably suspect he'll end up at Chelsea for about £70 million.
You mentioned City there. I want to add a point, and I'm going to put my own ignorance here. There is a homegrown player requirement in the Premier League and in the Champions League as well. And homegrown player doesn't just mean, obviously, homegrown by the club. It also means association trained. Aren't City kind of in serious danger of just being able to register a teeny tiny squad or just a bunch of kids?
Well, yeah, particularly if Joe Hart leaving. Forward. I mean, they've got Delph, I suppose.
Yeah, but we're going to keep Delph around just because of his passport? Or are they going to have to spend big and start looking at guys like Barkley and whatever just to...
Well, I think that's part of the reason they're looking at guys like Walker and Rose. Yeah, English players are sort of... They have a dual purpose, if you see, almost.
They're probably going to have the most crucial summer of any club, I think. They've qualified for the Europa League now. Is that enough for Ronald Koeman to prove to the big clubs in Europe that he's worthy of the next step? But if he loses,
isn't it a bit mean towards Everton?
No, because the debate about Lukaku has now shifted to poor Lukaku. He needs to leave Everton because the reason he doesn't score against the big teams, the reason he's a flat track bully, is because he's not surrounded by players who are good enough that when they're put under pressure, they can still get him the ball to score. He gets very poor service in the big games because Everton just aren't good enough to compete with teams in the top six. That will rankle with Koeman. The only way he can convince Lukaku, and I still think Lukaku is capable of being convinced by Koeman of this, that they do have money and they can buy in the players that are required. And then on the flip side, Lukaku probably thinking, well, hang on, if the big battle is whether you keep Barkley or not, evidence of this is not enough, because Barkley is not in that, he's not that calibre of player. I'm sorry, he's not. There's a lot that's nice about him. It's great that he's an Everton youth player, and it'd be nice for them to keep him. But if you look at, I mean, Koeman was very keen on Sigurdsson. I don't know if he still is. But, you know, there's no comparison. You can't let sentiment get in the way of buying really great players. And if that's what it's boiling down to, then if I was Lukaku, I'd say, this is a stupid debate. I'm off. I need you to talk bigger than whether you're keeping Barkley or not.
Wow, all this negativity surrounding Everton after what is... I mean, they're kind of the best of the rest, right, James? I mean, can you put a positive spin on Everton?
I could definitely put a positive spin on Everton.
Thank you.
Because I don't know about Lukaku, but I think Everton have done very well, and I think Koeman in particular has done really well. I mean, as you say, they're the best of the rest. They're clear in seventh, and they've actually, albeit this result has dealt them a bit of a blow, but they're actually putting a bit of pressure on the top six, looking as if they might even have a chance of sneaking in there. And you look at that team, you've got the likes of Holgate, Davies and Calvert-Lewin, who are very, very young players. And when you consider that that was actually a knock on Koeman, that was something that people were saying to criticise Koeman, particularly at the start of the season, when Koeman was under a fair bit of pressure, when Everton, you know, in sort of October, November time, when Everton had a bit of a sticky run. I think they went to Southampton and lost, and people were saying, oh, look, you know, Claude Puel played a lot of young Southampton players in that game. And people were criticising Koeman and saying, you know, oh, yeah, you know, it was a real grumble against Koeman at Southampton that he never gave young players a chance. And actually, he's given a lot of young players a chance this season. And I think they've actually had a very, very good season.
All right, moving on to our debate. This week we're going to do things differently. There's just so much going on. So we're going to have a whole bunch of little teeny tiny cute little bite-sized mini debates. Joey Barton has been banned for 18 months for gambling on football. He made a statement saying that he has a problem. It's compulsive behavior. And he also pointed out the hypocrisy, I don't know if you used the word hypocrisy, but the fact that you've got Premier League clubs that are owned by bookmakers. You've got professional gamblers owning clubs. Well, next year, a club in the Premier League. And so you're under so much pressure, basically, to go and bet and have a flutter, and it's part of the national culture. And he talked about how even as a kid, they would bet on everything. It was a case of him somehow being let down. I mean, is there a parallel between this and perhaps alcoholism and some other substance abuse issues that footballers may face?
I don't think it's hypocrisy at all. I think it's really clear that you can't bet on football if you're a footballer. End of conversation.
Right. But he's an intelligent guy.
He's not that intelligent, because he said, I've never bet on a game I was involved in, and then we saw all the bets, and one of them was on him betting on himself to score. Well, he's an idiot.
He bet on hundreds of games. Maybe he forgot that particular one.
Well, I have no sympathy for Joey Barton whatsoever. He's been doing it for 12 years. The rules are clear. The FA warned him 3 years ago. And they've ended his career.
In the 63-page written reasons from the FA, they discuss his gambling addiction, and they conclude with various expert witnesses and doctors and so on that, yes, he does have a problem with gambling, but they did not feel that the addiction and the problems were sufficiently overbearing for him to have a blind spot about which sports he was betting on. So it's not like he was so ill that he couldn't distinguish between betting on a football match and betting on a boxing match.
So his
Joe Barton statement was actually very persuasive and very well written. And yes, it does seem slightly odd to punish someone who gambles so heavily when gambling is so intrinsic to the profitability of the game. There is an irony there, but it's completely not relevant to this case, because he hasn't got an illness that means he has to bet on football.
That's not what
gambling is.
Gateway into betting on football. There's nothing that shows that the advertising and sponsorship of football shirts, clubs, has got him engaged in this activity. He says he's been doing it since he was a child in Liverpool. So, I mean, it's a deeper question about gambling culture. It's not a football issue.
If this is the case, though, I mean, this is where I struggle with a little bit. And I appreciate that the FA are now experts and can decide who has a gambling compulsion and who just does it for whatever reason. But
no, they're not experts.
That's what Alison said. They said he doesn't have an illness.
No, they spoke to experts
who then said, yes, he has a problem with gambling.
But it's a psychiatrist.
They did speak to psychiatrists, and they said in their opinion the addiction wasn't so compelling that he couldn't distinguish between a football match that was illegal for him under FA rules to gamble on and betting on the outcome of a hockey game.
You and your experts, come on. Haven't we been through all this with Brexit? What I struggle with a tiny bit here is we seem to have sympathy for footballers who are alcoholics, right? Because it's part of their culture and they grow up and it's a compulsion. As far as I can tell, Joey Barton didn't do this to make money because he wasn't gambling enormous amounts and he's a very wealthy man to begin with. He didn't do this to fix games or whatever reason, right? Those are those two issues are very, very obvious. So to me, the only other reason you would consciously go and do something that's illegal in your chosen profession is if you've got some kind of problem, some kind of chemical imbalance in your brain, which is exactly the kind of thing that would lead you to drink a bottle of Jack Daniels before breakfast.
And that's why they concluded the illness that he has was not so overwhelming that he couldn't. They interviewed him and he said, I understand the rules.
But in the same way an alcoholic would say, I understand that drinking 12 pints a night is bad for me, right?
Sure, but you can have sympathy for him for his condition, addiction, whatever, and you can try and support him and help him through that without endorsing his, in football terms, illegal activity. If someone was addicted to drugs,
I don't think anybody would endorse it. I mean, I don't.
So why is there an issue with the ban? If someone was addicted to drugs, you would help them, but you wouldn't say carry on taking drugs and keep playing football. If they were performance enhancing or if they were banned substances, you know?
Right. So a lot of people, James, I think Sean Dyche came out and said, you know, Cantona got, was it 6 months, 9 months banned for what he did. Mm-hmm. And this guy gets 18 months for having a wee flutter, which is part of your culture.
Mm.
You grew up in this culture. You have a wee flutter from time to time, right?
I literally never have a wee flutter. Okay. But
Do you see Deitch's argument?
I totally see that argument. The relativism argument is kind of... I think you will always be able to find examples of where people have been punished leniently in the past and be able to kind of set it against this and say, oh, well, wasn't this actually worse? I do kind of have sympathy with the argument that he has an addiction, but I also think that it is one of those cases where the punishment to an extent does have to be, it does have to send a message that the integrity of the game is paramount. And if you look at the bets that Joey Barton placed, to me, by far the most serious one was the one that he placed in a game, Manchester City against Fulham, where he laid Georgios Samaras as first goal scorer. And he was playing in that match. You know, he was the dead ball striker. He was the free kick taker.
Same reason that we have rules on insider trading in the stock market, right? Just the mere fact that you are a professional football player, if you are a serious gambler, and by that I mean a gambler takes it seriously, means that you've got access to information that other people in the market don't have, and that gives you an unfair edge. I mean, it's... I don't think there's an issue. I was just kind of more interested in the general idea that it seems that people have had more sympathy for some of the other silly things he did earlier in his career, frankly, than they do for this, apart from Sean Dyche, but obviously that's his manager.
The alternative would have been to say, look, the 18-month ban, which the FA says is the absolute minimum they could have applied, because it's supposed to be, he would have got 90 months ban if they'd taken each count.
90 months ban.
Is it six months per betting on your own or against your own team? Anyway, so they said it was the absolute minimum they could find. But because it does effectively end his career, because he's not, at 18 right. months out, he's too old, isn't he, to come back properly at a senior, significant level. What they could have done is said, 18 months is the minimum we can give him, but we do want to show that we take addiction seriously, and because this would spell the end of his career, we will commute it to say 9 months, he would have to undertake all these programs, and we would help make sure he keeps fit, and we would like to see him come back and have a last hurrah as a player, and then his appeal would have almost no basis at all, and he would have to accept that because it is the end of his career. I think, you know, the appeal thing will go on and on and on, and no one will really ever feel they have, and no one's ever learned a lesson from this. It's an awkward thing because it's at the end of his career, I think.
I'll leave you with this thought, though, about gambling and whatnot. Many, many years ago, I read Rio Ferdinand's autobiography, and in it, he talked about how he liked to gamble, and one day he went and met with his bookie, and he had a good run or whatever, and he met his bookie in a car park who basically gave him a bin liner filled with money. Now, I'm assuming that when you bet on Betfair, the Betfair man doesn't come by with a bin liner full of cash. So I don't even want to know why he was getting money in cash or whatever. This is in Rio's book, by the way. But we should be aware that you need to have very clear rules of this and very clear thinking. Because if you do things incorrectly, and if you don't treat the problem at source, if you don't educate people on the risk that James and Matt and Allison talked about, you're going to have people going who are addicted who will simply bet illegally. And then you're dealing with cash, you're dealing with money laundering, you're dealing with tax evasion, and you're dealing with far more sinister things, because people who carry around bin liners full stuff with cash in car parks often, I'm guessing, as a population set, probably aren't people who play by the rules.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jose Mourinho. I know this is the only time, the only segment where we'll talk about it. And I had somebody go and say, you're going to spend 50 minutes talking about it. We won't spend 50 minutes on it. He complained that it was inhuman for Manchester United to be forced to play 9 games in the month of April. On our show last night on ESPN, we actually ran through the teams that have played 9 games this April. And it's like Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund, Celta Vigo. I kind of see this as like the real problem here isn't the 9 games in April. It's the fact that United didn't win all of them because he hasn't played 9 games in a month, but he's played 8 games in a month plenty of times. And the real problem is that his best players are injured or unavailable, as are most of his defenders. Not just the good ones, but the bad ones too. Am I wrong here in that this is just kind of like, all right, let me give them something else to talk about so that we don't talk about, say, Rashford diving? Is that, I mean...
Absolutely.
Is
he going to take it, the fixture list to the Court of Human Rights? I mean, it's ridiculous.
I think he has a point about fixture congestion in general, but also United have been doing pretty well in the month of April, right?
The fixture list is daft, but it's not a new thing and it's not unique to Manchester United. I think the Di Matteo Champions League winning season and they got to the cup final, they may have played 10 games in April.
And they're luckier than most teams. They seem to have this conveyor belt of replacements.
Anybody want to endorse my plan to scrap the League Cup and reduce the Premier League to 16 teams or 18 if you must?
I'd scrap the League Cup, yeah.
You don't want to reduce the Premier League?
I thought the kind of the best idea, which is not happening, but the kind of 5 leagues of 20, sort of the extra football league. Because, if Jose thinks the Premier League is inhuman, he should check out the Championship, which is, barbaric.
They don't play in the Europa League and the Champions League.
No, but they play in other cups and they play an extra 8 league games.
But they'll get knocked out early in the, because they're not as good, right, in the cut league. Doesn't that balance out? Do they really, and I know they play 46 league games, but does that not balance out a little bit?
It doesn't bit, but if you get on any sort of cup run and have replays, then you've got big problems in the league and you end up with extra games towards the end of the season. And you've obviously generally got a far smaller squad and inferior players. So,
unless you do what you propose and scrap the League Cup, you could only ever you could maybe say, scrap the two-legged semi of the League Cup. But otherwise, you would have to take quite a drastic measure. I think with the issue of fixture congestion, and I'm going to bring in something completely outside football here.
Go for it.
We've just had in American football the NFL draft, where, yes, for people who don't know, the worst team from the previous season gets the top pick of the best of the new intake of players, and the second worst team gets the second pick. And so forth. So it's kind of a way that it's a very kind of artificial but effective way that the league has
it
a kind of
socialism. Take from the rich and the hardworking
of equalising itself.
Yes.
And there's practically nothing like that in English football or indeed European football. And almost the only way in which the one of the only sort of balancing factors in which teams suffer for being good is that they have to play a lot more fixtures. It's one of the only sort of balancing forces. So, for example, when Man United went to or played Swansea this weekend, they'd played something like 19 more games this season by virtue of being a better, more right. successful team who have progressed further.
This is what they should do. They should have a rule that if in the first half of the season you beat your opponent by, let's say, 3 or more goals at home, 2 or more goals away, you don't have to play them in the return leg. They automatically get a defeat. That way you would free up fixture congestion considerably, and you wouldn't be punishing the good teams by making them go all the way to Europa League semifinals and the League Cup final and all this stuff, right? You're with me, right, Husey?
It sounds like you just want to basically play the ICC Champions Cup all season. And get rid of all the teams.
I was joking there. Right, moving on. As you know, I don't talk about the lower leagues. I don't follow them. But I do follow people I like on Twitter, and I like Mr. James Masters, who former colleague, and a big Leighton Orient fan, who unfortunately he's cursed by being a Leighton Orient fan. He tweeted a picture of his season ticket. He went to 15 home games this season and saw Leighton Orient lose 15 games. For those who don't know, Leighton Orient are owned by an Italian man named Francesco Becchetti, who is a complete, I think, you won't mind me saying this, oddball. He decided that, like, because Albania is geographically close to Italy, he decided, I'm going to just give you a little Becchetti anecdote because I think this kind of sums the guy up. He decided that he was going to go to Albania, where the cost of living is very low. And he was going to open a TV channel in Albania and get it to broadcast to Italy, so he wouldn't need a license. And he was going to basically take the formats of every successful Italian TV format. He was going to replicate it 100%, right down to identical sets, obviously different presenters and whatnot. Now, clearly there's issues of copyright and whatever. But hey, it's Albania. Who cares? Who's going to... People did sue him, but hey, never went anywhere, right? Nobody wants to get tangled into 10 years of trials. So this is the kind of stuff he does. And he buys Leighton Orient. He actually runs... He ran a reality TV show on his Albanian-Italian television channel where people could go. And he would take like sort of 10 aspiring footballers, put them in some ugly row house in East London and send them to train with Leighton Orient, and then the best guy would go and win, and it was supposed to be all exciting. And of course, nobody watched it except for Becchetti and his family. But the bottom line is the club, serious debts. They think narrowly avoided winding up order. The Leighton Orient fans protested in their league match against Colchester, which I believe they were losing at the time. When 5 minutes from time, there was a peaceful pitch invasion. Personally, I don't condone violence of any kind. It was peaceful. I'm all for public disobedience, civil disobedience of this kind. So all these guys went on the pitch, expressed their displeasure. I think our headline in the paper was actually Football League deceives them, because after they made their protest on the pitch, Football League like, all right, the match has been abandoned. Everybody go home. They took the nets down, right? They pretend like everybody's gone. So then everybody leaves, streams out into East London. And then, an hour later?
They tiptoed back in.
They tiptoed back onto the pitch and played out the final 5 minutes. And they said
They played it on tippy toes as well, so no one would hear them.
Now, I find this absolutely appalling. I mean, I really... Football League justified it saying that, well, Colchester have a chance to reach the playoffs. Which we need to preserve the integrity of the game. There was no integrity to the game because Leighton Orient didn't go and try... Well, were they 3-0 down?
3-1.
He didn't go and try to win the game in the last 5 minutes. So you actually preserve the integrity of Diddley Squat. Frankly, if you have a pitch invasion, in normal countries, I don't know what the rule is here, you forfeit the game, right? So Leighton Orient had forfeited the game. It didn't matter. Going and playing the last 5 minutes... I think is appalling for denying them the right to those last 5 minutes, right, which they paid for and were entitled to go see. I hope James Masters does it. I hope James Masters goes there with his season ticket and says, you know what, those last 5 minutes, I paid for those, and you denied me that right.
The protesters didn't want the last 5 minutes. That was the point of their protest. They wanted to make headlines by making the match null and void.
Right, but once you say
destroy the match.
That's fine. But once you say the match is abandoned, James Masters goes home. He doesn't stick around, right? But the match wasn't abandoned.
No, but before that, it reached that point, they'd asked them to clear the pitch, and they weren't
clearing the pitch. Just say the match is abandoned.
Well, no, why should you abandon the game? Because
that's what the rules say. If there's a pitch invasion, you abandon the game. You don't go and rub the rub it in the faces of those fans who would have wanted to see them paid for those last 5 minutes, right? If you have to abandon the match because of safety concerns or whatever else, you abandon the match. It's over.
But then they should replay the next, behind closed.
You replay. Forfeit the game.
Yeah, but then if you did that, then you'd be giving fans all over the country incentive to just run on whenever they wanted to.
And you wouldn't, because if you do it, you get arrested. If you do it for no reason, you get arrested and you get in trouble. You really think fans are just going to start running into the game? This is what happens in most of the world, and I assume is what happens here too. You forfeit the game. If there's a pitch invasion, the game can't continue, right?
I can't recall a game ever being forfeited.
I'm sure it happened in the 70s. Tony Evans were here. I'm sure he'd remember. anybody want to stick up for Bichetti?
Well, no.
No?
That's not the point here, is it?
Well, I stick up for the Football League because...
Because someone could sue the Football League if they missed out on a playoff place and say
they're not
Colchester.
Going to miss out on the because they've forfeited the game. Colchester get their 3 points.
Yeah, but if you're not exactly, what if you're Colchester's nearest rival for those points, and you miss out on the playoffs because Colchester get the 3 points? You might say, well, you've got to play things properly.
I think it's all nonsense, and they set a really, really bad precedent by being deceptive, and I think our headline writer was correct in using the term deceive.
Yeah, no, my initial reaction was, that's mean.
Right, enough of this. How about some quick hits? Swansea go a goal down at the Theatre of Dreams, but they plug away and eventually equalise thanks to a Gylfi Sigurdsson free kick. Alison, you've been assigned this one because you're Gylfi's biggest fan at the Times, but also, do you want to explain the weird back and forth off the goal line from Herrera?
Yeah, well... You know, Herrera knows his football, knows Gylfi Sigurdsson's going to score from that position, is capable of scoring from there. So he thinks, oh, I'll stand on the line, I'll make it difficult for him. But that means that Llorente can drift in and cause problems for De Gea. So De Gea says, no, I don't like this. Go back to where you were the whole time. Iceman Gylfi looks at it like they're mice trying to flick his tail, and he swats them aside and scores the perfect free kick. And I don't know if I am the biggest fan on the Times, because Paul Hurst gave Gylfi 9 out of 10 in his ratings for that game.
Ooh, you've never given Gylfi 10, have you?
No.
United take the lead in that game with a rather controversial penalty won by Marcus Rashford. Hughesy, was it his dive? Can we end this nonsense whereby only foreign players cheat? And given how much I think most neutrals love Marcus Rashford, is there a sort of a melancholy loss of innocence there that our golden boy is just like any other professional footballer?
I'm not sure. I think all footballers are the same. Most of them dive. It's just a question of how good they are at it. And it was an appalling dive. That was the thing about it. It was just so obvious. So I can see why Paul Clement was annoyed. But equally, if it had been one of his players, he would have accepted it. So the whole thing is, frankly, absurd and hypocritical. All footballers cheat. All fans would probably accept their players cheating, and managers should stop moaning about it.
Welcome to the dark, cynical world of Matt Hughes. Burnley win their first away game of the season, halt Crystal Palace's run, and pretty much guarantee that they're going to be back next season. James, this is pretty huge, isn't it? Should we be making a bigger deal of Sean Dyche and his gravelly voice?
Yeah, I think Sean Dyche's done well this season. I think if you look at Burnley's squad, and I would say Bournemouth squad as well, they're both squads where you would expect the teams to be right in the thick of a relegation scrap. They've done well to kind of stay out of it for the most part. So I think both those managers have done well this season.
Yeah, except one of them gets mentioned for the Arsenal job and the other one just gets made fun of for his voice. A late goal from Gabriel Jesus gives Manchester City the draw at Middlesbrough, but there was another highly controversial penalty awarded to Leroy Sané. Alison, you're the qualified ref. Your take?
Oh, well, of all the controversial incidents over the weekend, this was the most dispiriting. And the way Sané sat there afterwards, he looked as guilty as anything. He knew he'd completely conned the referee. And I don't know, maybe referees just need to go on some specialist spot the cheat course, because it's really hard. If someone's, as Matt said, if you're talented at cheating, you've got to learn how to spot it.
Interestingly enough, there was a dive by Kevin Strootman in the Rome Derby to win a penalty. And it looks as if that's going to be punished retrospectively, or it's going to be cited for retrospective punishment, which in Italy you can do only in the most egregious, obvious, open and shut cases.
I actually thought, you may have your own thoughts on this. I think, I'm not saying it wasn't a dive, but I think dives of that nature, where he kind of jumped up, didn't he, and sort of, you know, leapt over the tackle, as it were.
You're about Strootman.
The Strootman dive. They're almost more excusable than, you know, dives like the sort of, you know, the Rashford and Sane dive, where you sort of lean into the player and see...
The problem wasn't that he jumped up, is that he pretended he was hit when he landed back on the ground.
Sure, but I'm not saying he didn't dive, but... Hey. The attacking player can actually argue, because, you know, the leg did come kind of, you know, right, swinging in, that they're taking evasive action, right, and that it's their right. You know, if they see a boot swinging in, right, you know...
That's better than somebody looking for a penalty.
That's better than somebody, you know,
running towards, yeah,
exactly,
someone.
Exactly, yeah. Hooking their foot, exactly, in and sort of...
The problem with Strootman was that he then pretended he was hurt,
yeah,
you know, which he wasn't. Marco Silva just gets hotter and hotter as Hull continue to creep towards safety, grabbing a draw at Southampton with some Eldin Jakubovic penalty-saving heroics. Husey, they're up 2 on Swansea and 6 on Burrow. How do you see it? You've already been all negative about Burrow. And more importantly, do you think he's going to stick around if they stay up? Would you stick around?
Depends what I was offered, I suppose. It's be really interesting one. Depends what offers he gets. I can't see him getting another Premier League job yet, but he might get offers from Europe, so it's kind of up to him, and it depends if Hull the ownership situation there is fluid for a start, and also depends on if they really want to make a go of this and kick on and give him a budget. If they stay up this year, it will be a miracle and they will have got away with it, because this whole season has been a mess, and they'll be indebted to Jorge Mendes, I suppose, for finding Marco Silva.
You know, you wouldn't get the heck out of Dodge if you were Marco Silva, given the ownership situation?
Well,
what happens?
It would depend on that, wouldn't it? I mean, it's ultimately a Premier League job. If they're going to give him some money to spend and a big contract, then I would... buy a nice house in sort of North Yorkshire and stay there for the rest of my days.
James, Sunderland are down after 10 seasons in the Premier League. Now, you're young enough that you probably don't remember and can't imagine a Premier League without the Stadium of Light. Some of us are so old, we remember Roker Park. But anyway, what are your thoughts and feelings on this emotional day?
Well,
come on, go all Culk it on us.
I mean, it's been coming, hasn't it? I mean, we've all kind of sat here and said that they look doomed, and so it's turned out. I do feel in the case of Sunderland, when season after season, you just kind of scrape through by the skin of your teeth, and like your kind of only goal is to avoid relegation. You circle the drain enough times, eventually you will go down it. And I think even for clubs with the most meagre resources, after they've, you know, if they come up after a few seasons, you've got to start, you know, setting objectives a bit higher than simply just staying up. And I think in Sunderland's case, they're actually a relatively well-resourced club. You know, they've got a big stadium. Their sights should have been set a lot higher. And
James Gearbrand calls the championship the sewer. That's effectively what he said.
Seriously, we've had two major clickbait headlines thus far. Mm. I don't think that's as bad as we don't need another Paul Scholes. But still.
Gav, I've got a question for you.
Go for it.
Bayern are, once again, champions of Germany. Yawn, yawn. But was this season really a success for Ancelotti?
Well, you can read my excellent column in The Game on Monday and find out. You can look at this in so many different ways. Obviously, knocked out by Real Madrid in the Champions League quarterfinals, knocked out by Borussia Dortmund in the German Cup semis. But then again, the Borussia Dortmund game was a game they dominated and should have won. And the Real Madrid game had some rather dubious officiating that went against them. I think you have to judge beyond that. I think what's going to be really interesting is what happens next year. It's Xabi Alonso and Philipp Lahm are moving on. Frank Ribery's 34, Arjen Robben's 33. They've got a whole bunch of young players there. So the question is, can Ancelotti integrate them? Who do they sign? A lot of rumors about Alexis Sanchez being a target. And can they kick on? But yeah, it's 14 league titles in 19 seasons for Bayern Munich. So in the last 20 years, Nobody has managed Bayern Munich without winning the title, except for one man. Anybody want to guess who that was?
Klinsy.
There you go. Klinsy, yes, that's right. Former Tottenham legend, Jürgen Klinsmann. Please note the fact that we did not discuss HMRC and image rights and Lee Charnley getting arrested because, well, we thought it would all bore you. My guests today have been the excellent Matt Hughes, the excellent Alison Rudd, and the excellent James Gearbrand. Remember, just £12 for a 12-week trial. If you want to subscribe to our newspaper, lots of good stuff in there and a neat app as well. Just search The Times online. Also, press that subscribe button on wherever you choose to download your podcast. And please leave us a review on iTunes because it'll help other people find us. And then we'll grow and become a larger, happier family. Till next time. Bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.